on tape? Good. You're taping right now? All right.
From Seattle, the Earth on the Air Radio Cooperative presents Earth on the Air. During the next 30 minutes, Earth on the Air's independent contributors explore how indigenous people are making connections with the rest of the world.
We'll visit Native American tribes trying to preserve their cultures while developing economically.
We'll check on the struggles facing the indigenous peoples of Ecuador, Australia, and southern Siberia.
Not to mention the state of Native empowerment at the United Nations.
Also music, poetry, and more.
First, let's visit the Tulalip Reservation's longhouse, just north of Seattle, where tribal leaders from all over the world gathered for a very special elders' council. The purpose of the powwow was to share a Native perspective on our environmental problems.
Today's the day to talk about the earth.
The best managers in the world was Indian people, indigenous people. It's only until the other people start coming in, giving us educations, making us learn how to speak from our mind and not our heart. It's hard to talk about Indian when you've got to speak with this English language. Seven generations ahead of us is who we're talking about, who we're trying to protect Mother Earth for.
My grandfather charged me at the age of seven to take care of this world as he was charged by his grandfather, Mukwiatsa. I have taken my grandchildren to the same spot and charged them to take care of it.
What does Raven see as he flies over the rivers? What does Raven see as he flies over the mountains? Raven is weeping over the things that we have done to ourselves. For it's easy for man to blame another man for the way he is. It isn't until we begin to take responsibility and begin to say, we are the ones that are at fault. We need to change, and we can change.
How to love yourself. That's what our Mother Earth talks about. You see people when they're dancing, they're shaking off all their bad feelings on Mother Earth. She'll accept it. You see people when they cry, their tears don't fall up, they drop down to Mother Earth. She'll accept your pain. Just like your very own real mother, she'll draw your pain and pump energy back into you. She'll put energy back into your system because she's a true mother. A true mother.
Before this century, the Puyallup Nation used to encompass much of what is now Tacoma, Washington. That was before the city turned into one of the most important ports in the region. The Puyallups are still around, though, on a modest reservation just north of town. In 1988, after 80 years of battling in the courts, a settlement was reached between the tribe and state, federal, and local agencies to compensate the Puyallups for their usurped lands. Ted Jessen visited the Puyallups recently to find out, 3 years later, how they're feeling about the settlement.
In the last 100 years, the reservation has been transformed from a wilderness of ancient firs and cedars, growing high above a great river delta of open wetlands, into a city of lights and industry with gangs and gridlock.
Prior to the coming of the white people to this area, the idea of ownership of land was a very foreign. You used what you needed from the land, and you respected the land for what it was. It gave bounty.
Puyallup Ronald Simpson.
wasn't that long ago in my lifetime that I've seen fish run so thick in some of these streams that you couldn't get in to go swimming in the creek or anything. Now you go back and look in the same places, and you have to watch a long time just to see one fish. I mean, my mother talks about going out fishing at Brown's Point with the fish traps. And nowadays, if you go out anywhere close to that area and even tried to put a fish trap in there, somebody would be out there with a shotgun shooting you.
Simpson served on the tribal committee that worked on the 1988 land settlement. He, like most Puyallups, was underwhelmed with the compromise that was finally agreed upon. But it seemed clear that the tribe would never get its land back from the city of Tacoma. A cash and land payment seemed to make more sense than an endless series of court battles.
Based on some of the cases that have made it to the Supreme Court, the attitude was getting to be, well, we know a great injustice was done to you, but it's a little too late to rectify anything about it right now. And that's where we were sitting right then.
The settlement established a trust fund to provide for the tribe. It also guaranteed fishing rights and initiated a series of land trades which gave the Puyallups waterfront and timberland properties, many of which were badly polluted. But what affected each individual most directly was a cash payment of $20,000 per person. Simpson says the infusion of new money and land was definitely a mixed blessing.
I figure we got a penny on a dollar. It gave everybody a chance to go out and be rich for a short while. Not very rich, but it gave them a certain amount of money to feel like, after all these years, we've gotten something. I've got a house that I'm paying on for 30 years, so what? I've got something to show for my $20,000, and a lot of other people do too.
Most Puyallups I spoke with agreed with Simpson's lukewarm appraisal of the settlement, like this woman, who also served on the settlement committee.
Is my name going to be in here?
Not if you don't want to be.
I don't want my name on there. No. I never really was for it just because of the things that had gone on in the past, and I don't think it benefited the elders and the youth. We exchanged a lot of good property for contaminated property, and these things bugged me. I never was for it, and it's kind of strange because I was on the committee, and we had hoped for a lot more and a lot more clean properties that our kids can grow up on and that don't have to be taken out in toxic barrels. The quote that meant a lot to me during the settlement I got from a book that had quotes from Chief Joseph, and this person, it said, look twice at a two-faced man, and I think that's what the other side, the non-Indian side, was to me.
But Ronald Simpson says there are lasting benefits from the settlement. Lands traded to the Puyallups must be cleaned up. An environmental impact section calls for wetlands, water quality, and salmon runs to be restored in areas affecting the tribe. And because they're responsible for monitoring, the Puyallups are becoming leaders in environmental policy in the Tacoma area.
There are literally in the document itself definite standards. If you destroy any wetlands, you're going to rebuild the wetlands. The Port of Tacoma learned that the hard way. How do you rebuild a marshland? We're learning.
Within my country lies your country. The land lies whole under your boundaries, your straight lines, your strange names. Not like my names, the old names, Shinnecock, Massapequa, Conetquat, Havasu. Within my country lies your country. You do not remember? You do not know me. I pass unknown, unremembered. Raven, raccoon, bobcat, bear, osprey, otter, owl. I move silently among you, unseen because you do not want to see me, I pass over your fences, across your highways, among your litter. Past the places you say you now own. As if you could own a place. Whoever gave you such an idea? Within my country lies your country. Your country lies about its birth. Born, you say, of the desire for freedom. Born truly of theft, murder, deceit, and greed beyond comprehension. But I know what you have forgotten. You. Your country will pass as the clouds pass. Even as that which you think is your power is passing, as if power was your own. Whoever gave you such an idea? It will all pass. And all that will remain will be shattered windows becoming silica and sand. Within my country lies your country. I lie in wait.
Is America better or worse off since its westernization, its colonialization?
That's a hard question to answer. I would imagine it's better off.
All I can really say is that I'm happy where the country is right now.
I think the Indian culture was right on with a lot of things. And the way to treat people and animals and the earth and everything else. And I think we've moved away from that.
Better because the people have a better understanding of where they're going.
We have all this new technology, and it's going to backfire on us pretty soon.
Most everyone gets fed. We live pretty clean lives. People are living longer.
There aren't as many trees around, and seems like a lot of animals are becoming extinct, and there are a lot of signals that we should be paying attention to things that we're not.
Better off for people, worse off for the world.
Yeah, life's simpler for people, but it's becoming more difficult for the environment, for wildlife. We're taking away all of the world.
Where do you think we're headed from here?
Scared to say.
Oh, we'll all blow up. If we don't watch what we're doing.
I think we're all going to burn. I don't know. It's just, the earth is just dying. I don't know. It's just, it's not going to get any better.
Well, it seems that we might be at a turning point. I'd like to be optimistic. I have two small children.
Someplace better. Someplace better. I'm sure.
I think we're sort of in adolescence right now. And so we're like, we've got a lot of pimples all over the place. And either we're going to self-destruct or we'll pull ourselves out of it and perhaps we'll get to a better place. I don't know.
There'll be a different species in charge of the earth in a few years.
Like?
A thousand years. Who knows? People eventually kill themselves off, I believe.
Yeah. Morbid.
On the northwestern coast of South America lies a lush, mountainous country about the size of Oklahoma. Ecuador still has a large indigenous population. It's also a country rich in oil and other valuable natural resources, a ripe setting for the sort of exploitation of native areas that the American continent has grown so accustomed to. But in Ecuador, the natives are fighting back. Jean-Paul Bardou met up with Leonardo Viteri. Viteri represents the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador.
Leonardo Viteri is a short, dark man with vivacious eyes. He's very calm and does not put out much energy for effects. One can sense the weight of history in his gaze. He described what kind of life the natives of Ecuador had before they were fully penetrated by our civilization in the 1960s. The picture he drew for me was the typical idyllic view of a people living a peaceful life in harmony with nature. No pollution, no deforestation, no poverty, no greed.
Y hemos desarrollado también aspectos artísticos como la música, la cerámica, los instrumentos,
We developed artistic aspects, such as music, ceramics, and instruments. Our legends, our oral traditions, have remained very strong, which has been useful to transmit to our future generations all the culture and history that we have acquired in the course of our existence.
In the 60s, corporations from the civilized world looking for oil found the forests of South America to be promising sources of the gooey black stuff. The natives did not welcome the intrusion, so the conglomerates temporarily gave up. Next came the religious sects to pacify the natives, domesticate them, Viteri said, getting the terrain ready for the return of the oil companies. Oil exploration went into full-scale operation, shortly followed by logging and such environmental aberrations as large-scale monoculture and pesticide use. The impact on waterways was dramatic. Refuse from oil drilling and chemical farming soon killed off the fish in streams and rivers, taking away from the natives one of their major food supplies. Until the very recent past, indigenous response had been rather tempered. In June of 1989, the indigenous people of Ecuador started a new strategy. In a well-coordinated effort, roadblocks, strikes, they paralyzed the country so their demands would be heard and listened to. Leonardo Viteri and his people believe that it is important for their survival to connect with people of the world that are stricken by similar blights.
Nuestro objetivo es alimentar muy fuertemente el contacto internacional, porque no podemos los pueblos indígenas.
Our objective is to strengthen international communication, because indigenous people may very easily be isolated from the international scene. We may end up being overlooked in our unnoticed territories. Thus, we too must propose new alternatives to face the present economic, environmental, and moral crisis that the world is facing. On the one side, we let the world know about the problems taking place in our country, and on the other, we present options and our knowledge in an effort to establish a cooperative exchange.
The indigenous people of Ecuador are in the process of negotiating basic rights with the government. Viteri says that if all efforts fail, Ecuador could soon become the stage for violent native uprisings. In that country, natives comprise between 25 and 40% of the population.
Next on Earth on the Air, Lisa Bellet lives in Melbourne. She's Koori. That is, she's an Aboriginal Australian. Her tribe is Nunukul. Bellet says the roots of racism run deep in Australia.
The dominant culture, which is the white culture, which invaded our land 203 years ago and founded Australia on the basis of terra nullius, which is Latin for empty land, which meant that they didn't acknowledge that Aboriginal people existed in our country, right? So that they just treated us like animals. In fact, at one stage there were laws in the land which Aboriginal people were counted as part of the flora and fauna.
Bellet is a social worker and counsellor. These days, she's particularly interested in helping Koori's reunite with their families. Through the mid-1970s, it was common practice in Australia for the state to take Koori children from their parents and place them in foster homes. It happened to Bellet, and she only found her family as an adult. She says this practice has done terrible things to the Koori psyche.
There's a lot of hurt, and there's a lot of blame that goes on when children have been removed and resentful. And I tell you what, I mean, I used to have a really, really bad attitude towards Indigenous people because I got my knowledge bases from the education system, which talked about us as you know, being savages. I mean, that was the language that was used. And I mean, I say to people, look, I could consider myself a racist, you know, and you think you've got problems being a white person and saying, look, this is all too much. I don't understand, you know, what Aboriginal people are on about, and I don't know what to do. Well, I mean, try being an Aboriginal person and not knowing that you're Aboriginal, but being treated like one, and then trying to understand where you fit in. I mean, for a while I was really confused. I mean, I was told by my friends, when you find out who your family is, you are going to lose the friends that you've got now. And I said, well, why? Why should I lose, you know, these people that are maybe friends for 5, 10, 15 years, you know? And then people say, well, you know, they're not going to be able to deal with you coming home, you know, finding out who you really are. But that process still hurt. Yeah.
Is it more of a thing that you're just trying to explore what it feels like, explore your roots, or is there something a special connection with other Indigenous people? Do you feel like an Indigenous person, or do you feel like a non-Indigenous person that's trying to feel like an Indigenous person? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean, and it's I mean, I'm me. Yeah, you connect with Indigenous people like that. There is something, but I can't explain it. It's like you know what people have gone through, and you can just sometimes, you know, you just see each other. There might be two or three Indigenous people in a meeting of, say, 1,000 white people or mixture of cultures, right? But you're the only two or three Indigenous people, and you see each other, and you just breathe this sigh of relief. You think, great, you know, we can just go sit somewhere quietly, we don't have to say anything, you know, we can just get our energy levels up again. And but I can't explain. I mean, you know, maybe some anthropologist has got a theory on it somewhere, and they'll explain it, like they've explained a lot of things about our people. The other thing I wanted to say too, if I can say this, I'll say it anyway, is I come over to America, right, and I met up with this Australian person who's a lovely woman, but she came over 10,000 miles to learn about Native spirituality, right, and I mean, that's fine, but I said to her, look, you know, instead of going all the way to North America and finding about Native American spirituality, you know, try and get in touch with your own spirituality, you know, but don't just take things out of context. They don't find out about North America and don't or Australia and ignore Aboriginal deaths in custody, you know. I mean, ignore the fact that, you know, unemployment in our community is, say, 60-70%, you know, and some Aboriginal communities it's 100% unemployment, or the fact that, you know, 1991 average life expectancy of a Koori male is 42 in Victoria and 46 for a Koori woman, you know. I mean, this is just reality, you know, of us.
Social worker Lisa Bellet was the first Aboriginal to be elected to public office in Victoria. She also hosts a public radio show in Melbourne called Not Another Koori Radio Show.
A musician and singer from a South Siberian Buryat village. Buryats recently got a lesson in the politics of identity. They'd not been in the habit of calling themselves Indigenous until Native rights activist Gretchen Kapke visited Buryatia and offered them a fresh perspective. As a citizen diplomat, Kapke helps Indigenous cultures find common ground with other Natives.
The Buryat Republic is found right across the border from Mongolia, in southern Siberia, around Lake Baikal, which is a sacred site to the Buryat people. It's really a beautiful area. The culture is Tibetan Buddhist, in large part, and so there are Tibetan monasteries throughout Buryatia, and also part of the culture is traditional pre-Buddhist shamanic nature-based spirituality.
After Soviet glasnost, and especially after the failed coup, life for Native Buryats, in some respects, has become more difficult.
Now that everyone is free to speak their mind, and now that it is recognized that they are Indigenous people, suddenly those Europeans who previously didn't express any particularly condescending opinion about these peoples because it wasn't acceptable suddenly now it's acceptable. And so suddenly the indigenous people are being made to feel like third-class citizens, whereas before they're, on a certain level anyway, on a personal level, there hadn't been any indication of that. In schools, for example, the teachers treated the native students like any other student previously. Now, suddenly, they're saying, oh, you're a native student, you know, you're backward, you're disadvantaged, etc.
Politically, native Buryats have relatively little power.
In the indigenous governments in Siberia, there are also Europeans in the government, unlike our reservation system, where non-Indians are not allowed to participate in government and don't even have a vote on the reservation as to who's going to be tribal chair and so forth. And so it's very difficult for them to pass laws protecting traditional hunting and fishing rights if the Russians and Ukrainians in the government want to go into those areas and do development.
The Buryats' main strategy for self-determination has been to work toward reunification with Mongolia. Mongolians are their closest relatives. Citizen diplomat Kapke suggested to the members of the Buryat Committee of Education and Culture, who invited her to Buryatia, that they strive to identify with more than just Mongolia.
To open it up even broader and say, wait a minute, there are all these indigenous people all over the world who share the same issues, the same concerns, the same struggles as you do, and who have already been working to resolve some of the problems that you are now beginning to tackle. That realization was very exciting for them, to find out that they were not just another ethnicity, but that they were indigenous people and had special rights as indigenous people.
There's a whole body of international law specific to indigenous people. The United Nations not only affirms basic indigenous rights, it also addresses specific issues like hunting and fishing rights and self-determination. Russell Barsh is a native rights attorney. He represents British Columbia's Mi'kmaq Nation at the UN's Working Group on Indigenous Populations. Native groups participate in the UN only as special observers, but Barsh says opportunities for indigenous empowerment at the UN are increasing.
We first got in by using this disguise, by saying, oh, we're non-governmental organizations. We're just like Amnesty International. We're organizations set up to defend indigenous people's rights. And of course, we're not. Almost all the indigenous organizations that are there are, in fact, grassroots organizations which represent actual communities and are political movements rather than non-governmental organizations in the sense of something that has an office somewhere, a bunch of secretaries, and a lot of foundation funding. But it was the only way to get legal access to meetings, to be there.
Barsh and other native activists are pushing for a new UN classification, IPOs, Indigenous Peoples Organizations. Because of this push, he says, indigenous groups are being allowed to participate in some UN decision-making processes alongside UN members.
Things like this are beginning to make indigenous people a little bit more than non-governmental organizations. Not quite member states, but almost states. Call them nations in coming, nations that are about to be.
That's the show. Thanks for tuning in.
Don't forget, this is your program too. Find out how to participate in Earth on the Air, or find out more about any of the pieces you heard. Write us at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
That's Earth on the Air, P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
The poem, Within My Country, was written by Ellen Claver and produced by Terra Inferma in Denver.
We had additional help from Bill Svoboda, Craig McDonald, Susan Gleason, Kathy Bloom, Scott Bergen, and Melanie Schmeek.
Additional music was by David Hines, Jombie, and Randy. Production facilities provided by Jack Straw Productions in Seattle and KSER in Linwood, Washington.
If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-735-0230. Mention that you'd like program number 10. For Earth on the Air, this is Peter Maloff.
And I'm Janice Kane.